Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are going way back to the 18th century to the sweeping romantic scenery of France and Italy in Anne Radcliffe's most famous work, The Mysteries of Udolpho. Anne Radcliffe has been lost from mainstream classic literary canon. Only those who go out of their way to research Gothic literature, I feel like, seems to know anything about her. But she is considered to be the queen of female Gothic, setting the stage in the late 1790s for the genre in the centuries to come. And myself personally, I'm so glad I invested in reading her books because so many other more well-known classics in the 19th century do make reference to her novels, showing how popular she was in her own time. Like Uncle Silas by Sheridan Le Fanu, like said, oh, I feel like Adelaide in Romance of the Forest. I'm like, I've actually read that and I know what he's talking about.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember when we were talking, I've heard the name Anne Radcliffe, and I think the book that I hear most common with her name wasn't The Mysteries of Udolpho, but it was The Italian. And yeah, but I mean, you know, reading The Mystery of Udolpho was, I'm sure, I'm kind of curious now to read The Italian, but she is a very interesting woman. Unfortunately, it sounds like there's not a lot of information about her out in the world.
Yeah, no, there's not too much about her. And really, the way a lot of people get exposed to her nowadays is because in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, the main character is reading Mysteries of Udolpho. So people nowadays are like, oh, what was that? And then they go see, oh, it was an actual book. Like, that is one of the few ways that she has sort of stayed alive in mainstream culture.
That's really interesting, because I was reading another book, and it said the greatest thing about books is it leads you to more books. So even that far back, it would lead you to more books.
I'm just surprised that the first thing you thought of was The Italian, because yeah, definitely Mysteries of Udolpho is her most famous one. And as I mentioned in my classic top classic Gothic novels on BookTube, my favorite of hers so far is actually one of her older ones, not as famous, A Sicilian Romance.
I've heard of that one too. And I think I have heard of The Mysteries of Udolpho. And for some dumb reason, I always thought she wrote The Monk. But I think it's just kind of like there's a grouping of novels that kind of go in the same, like, well, obviously Gothic fiction. I will say reading this book made me have some realizations about my own Gothic literature preferences. And I think that was, it was a bit surprising to me.
Well, it makes sense that you associate with the monk, because the monk, like Vaketh, the monk, and all of Anne Radcliffe's, all of that is 18th century. So all of those, Castle of Otranto, all of those are the super early 18th century manifestations of Gothic literature.
Okay. Yeah, this definitely, one thing I will say about it, my preference aside, is this to me was like, okay, I feel like if I were doing an intro to Gothic literature, and maybe it goes without saying, but this is a book that I would be like, okay, we're starting here. I mean, even before The Castle of Otranto, I almost feel like this, The Castle of Otranto is so short in my mind. This is not short.
This is as long as the Bible.
Oh my God. It's so long. I mean,
I will admit that I had to cheat and I like looked at Spark Notes summaries for the last 100 pages. I just could not get.
Oh my God. Amy, that made me feel so much better, because I had to do the same thing. Because I, like I said, I've been working like a mad person. And then I was just like, oh my God, I'm not going to finish this. So thank you.
It's huge. Like I would read three more books in a month in what I would, you know, this one book.
And, you know, I think we've talked about this before, because I've been like, oh my gosh, these are so long. This one, like, and we were exchanging text messages and you're like, it just keeps going. And it's, And I was thinking the same thing. I was like, oh my God. I know that, like, that seems that that is definitely an attribute of, you know, older novels, but this one, I was like, good God, can we just move on? Not that it didn't have, but at the same time, I've been enjoying it. She is interesting in that way of writing.
Yeah, I, you know, for me, it was just purely a lack of time. It wasn't that, you know, if I truly had enough time, like, I would enjoy reading every single description of the romantic scenery. It's not like it was dull or dry in that way. I just did not have the time this month.
Well, me too. This is a huge book, and I would like to, it's one of those books that I would like to, like, have the, you know, maybe stop and start. I kind of read, which I've read, maybe I shouldn't, but I've kind of read multiple books at one time. And this would be one that I would like to just kind of, okay, I read a couple hundred pages and, you know, maybe come back to a little later. But yeah, so none of her descriptions, I don't think, you know, it's kind of a dichotomy because none of her words are really wasted. Her descriptions are great. And especially, I think I read that she never visited any of these places that she talks about, Italy or France.
No, she hasn't.
With to give such vivid descriptions, again, testament to reading. She got all of that through reading. So, okay, well, it is a long book. That is one thing that I think everybody needs to know, but I think it's worth, interesting woman that we don't know a lot about either. So,
yeah, I think she's basically, I hope I'm not confusing her with someone else, but I remember possibly reading a bio about her, and it was basically her marriage wasn't that great, so she spent her time writing.
That's interesting. The fact that I found that, I guess she published The Italian and then disappeared. Like, nobody heard from her. They thought maybe she went, like, was ended up in an insane asylum due to, or, you know, I probably used totally dated wording there, but she just disappeared, which that's kind of intriguing in a way that adds an element of gothicness about the author. So,
do you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of when Agatha Christie went missing for that week or so.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's a really good reference there. Okay.
All right then. But before we get right into it, shall we do the 60-second summary, which I don't know how we're going to do it with a book that is 675 pages, but I'll give it a try.
Please do, and I will do my best.
Okay, then. So let me get my timer. Okay, let's see. Okay, I'm going to start in 3, 2, 1. So Mysteries of Udolpho is all about Emily St. Aubert. Her father dies, which leaves her by her, in the guardianship of her aunt. Her aunt marries this really mean Italian named Montini. While this is happening, Emily has a crush on Valancourt, but her aunt doesn't approve of Valancourt, and then they whisk her away to Montini's, like, seat, his estate, Mysteries of Udolpho. Really crazy stuff happens. Montini tries to bamboozle her aunt into giving away the estate. Then the aunt dies and then goes to the, Emily gets her to sign away the estates that she inherited, but still won't let her go. Then she escapes, and then there's this whole new mystery with the Count, with another Count's family and Blanche, and then the question of the old Marchioness at Chateau LeBlanc, and yeah, and then there's the nun in the Sister Agnes, who is actually someone really not who we thought she was, and yeah, I'm out of time.
Wow, you got more in there that I, sorry. Okay, let me see if I can do this. I will not do as good of a job as you did. So 3, 2, 1. Okay, so Emily lives with her family in a castle, and her mother dies, and she is very upset. But in order to kind of get over her upsetness, she and her father travel, and he's so distraught. They think that this trip will help him get over the anguish and pain of losing the mother and the wife. And on this trip, they meet the young Valancourt. The father isn't getting better, so eventually he dies, and then Emily spends a lot of time crying. There, in between this, there is a castle where they're staying, and there's a ghost with some, well, a assumed goes, there's some music coming from somewhere. And then her father dies and she doesn't have any money. So she goes to live with her aunt. And then my time is up. So I think I got like, I don't
you
know.
You got the far. First 150 pages.
Good. Hey, you know what? That's fine. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, like I just glazed over her mother's death, because to me, like, the book doesn't really start until her father dies.
You're right. It's kind of like her mom dies, and then it's like, and then the kind of, yeah, it carries on with her father dying. But like, man, there was a lot of her like weeping and crying and just being distraught and dealing with her emotions. However, not a bad Gothic heroine.
No, that's one thing I wanted, yeah, that I was curious about what your impressions of Emily were, because again, like in Castles of Otranto, you know, there is the first, you know, there is the natural inclination to think, oh, she's not a very good heroine, just a damsel in distress that needs to be rescued. But as I pointed out in our Castle of Otranto episode with Isabella, I wouldn't say that these heroines of her are necessarily weak. They're just, you know, in a position where they don't have a lot of power. And in a lot of ways, they're exemplifying a lot of fortitude despite not having that much power. And I think it's, you know, kind of, you know, premature to dismiss them as just damsels in distress.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think, you know, and with Emily, she was being pushed into some various circumstances that made, you know, she kind of held her ground a little bit more over some other people. She did faint, though, right? She was fainting a bit, which...
Yeah, she was faint. Yeah, she fainted like a few times.
That was kind of appealing back in the day, I believe. They had the fainting couches and things like that to appear feeble and, you know, kind of helpless. I'm just remembering that this book took place... not in the time it was written, much earlier.
Yeah, 1584 or 85, something like that.
Yeah.
Basically 200 years prior to when it was written.
Okay. Which that just reminds me of the Castle of Otranto, because that took place in also in Italy. So it made me think of last time when we talked a lot about Orientalism, and we've talked about otherness in these Gothic novels. And I know that's something that you see in these books more than I've been able to see. So this taking place in Italy and you having more knowledge about kind of like the history of these places, was the Italian being othered in this book, or was that just a setting?
I think it's both. You know, again, I'm not as familiar with all the deep, you know, obviously the, you know, Europe has deep-rooted rivalries and, you know, tensions, and that's what, you know, unleashed two world wars out into the world. Right. But I'm not as familiar exactly with those intricacies. I could go on a tangent forever with Frankenstein last time, because that was specifically about Turks and about Arabs, and I knew exactly what was going on in the 19th century with those peoples during those times. But yeah, I think it's the same with Castle of Otranto, that they're putting the setting in Italy just for the pure, like, you know, eye candy, if you will, of being exotic and fancy like that, but also as a means of criticism that, oh, this doesn't happen in England, like these sort of corrupt churches or these corrupt, you know, nobles, that doesn't happen in England, that happens like in Italy, that happens on the continent.
Right. Okay. So it's like you're protected by your Britishness and whatever, but, you know, if you venture too far, then, you know, there's haunted castles and, ghosts, and I'm forgetting part of the ending, these hidden apartments, all kinds of just, like, in my opinion, cool Gothic stuff, but probably.
Yeah. So definitely, especially, you know, the Italians, because Italians definitely seem to be othered amongst Europeans more so than other Europeans. Like, just, I'm not sure exactly why, like, I don't know what specifically about Italian culture that it's worthy of being othered, but they would other everything. They othered even like the Welsh, the Irish, and the Scots who are right next door to them. So,
yeah, that's not one of the shining attributes of Gothic literature by any.
Yeah, and I think specifically with one thing to be said about the European context of when these books were written in Anne Radcliffe's time, because Anne Radcliffe wrote these in the 1790s. So what was the big thing that happened in 1789?
Oh my gosh, you're testing my history knowledge on a very brain-dead brain.
The French Revolution.
Oh, okay. The French. Oh my God, and I wrote a freaking paper about that. Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah. 1776 and 1789. Those are the revolutions.
Do you think there's any like sort of elements of like commentary on the French Revolution in this book by Anne Radcliffe?
You don't know how many dissertations there probably are about, you know, early Gothic literature in the 18th century and how it was influenced by all the changing ideals that occurred because of the French Revolution. And I think in Anne Radcliffe's stories, it takes the manifestation of the criticism of the corruption of the nobility.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because we have Robespierre cutting off Marie Antoinette's head and like down with the king and all of that stuff. Right. And so, you know, having all these corrupt noblemen, you know, persecuting our, you know, heroines is just a micro level of that phenomenon.
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like it wasn't as obvious as some other, or maybe it's very obvious to the, but. Interesting.
I think it certainly was very obvious, I think, to the readers at the time. And again, she's been lost to history for mainstream society. It's more like academics and, you know, nerds like us who know about her now. Right. But she was so popular in her own time. Like, she was more popular and more well-known than Jane Austen was in her own time.
Is that to me is so interesting because she, because like you said, it's not a name that I remember. I know so many people that are so excited about Jane Austen. And then, you know, even to the, when we're going to discuss a Jane Austen, right, book in the future, kind of related to this book, I'm like at a loss for words, I guess, but Anne Radcliffe influenced so many people that are, you know, kind of giants in Gothic literature, like Poe. For example,
And even Frankenstein, because Frankenstein still, even though it's 19th century, it's still heavy on that sublimity of nature that she was all about.
Whoa, and man, was she about the sublimity of nature. I think I
yes,
said that
tell me about
night.
Your impressions. Like I've read my first one that I read was Romance of the Forest, and I've since read Italian Sicilian Romance, and this is now my fourth one. But I'm curious, this is your first book you've read by her. What did you think of all of that emphasis on nature?
I mean, I'm kind of a tree hugging hippie, so like I don't mind that. And I did appreciate the you know, the cure for the father's like unwellness was to go out into nature. I think that is something that I've always found very interesting. You know, the Stanley Hotel, which Stephen Pan, you know, was the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. I visited that hotel, I think it was last year. I don't know. This year has been.
Is it as creepy in real life?
Oh my gosh. It's super cool. Yes. We did the paranormal tour and it was super.
Ooh.
It was fun. But the whole reason that a hotel exists is one of the brothers was advised to go west for cleaner air for his health. And I think that that's a really interesting concept as far as the sublimity of nature and going back to nature to get healthy. I feel like there are elements of that in our society today. But I also, when I initially made that comment, I think a couple of weeks ago, I was just thinking of her descriptions of, you know, the setting. It's like she uses a lot of words. I'm not going to call her wordy because that sounds insulting. But I think there's a tree in particular, and I'm kind of that makes various appearances. I believe it's at their home, and that's kind of what I thought. I don't know if you have some more, you know, insights, please, by all means.
Oh, no, it's just, you know, as I was always saying, that Gothic was always a facet of the wider Romanticism movement, and Anne Radcliffe definitely shows that. And of all the quotes about nature, I specifically honed in on one of them, which was in my book on page 189. And let me see, like, It was near midnight before they withdrew to the opera, where Emily was not so charmed, but that when she remembered the scene she had just quitted, she felt how infinitely inferior all the splendor of art is to the sublimity of nature. Her heart was not now affected. Tears of admiration did not start in her eyes. And when she viewed the vast expanse of ocean, the grandeur of the heavens, and listened to the rolling waters, and to the faint music that at intervals mingled with their roar, remembering these, the scene before her faded into insignificance.
Wow. Okay.
So this show, again, there were so many, you know, paragraphs about, you know, how wonderful nature is. But I think that one just shows how wonderful nature is specifically in comparison to man-made entertainments and man-made art. Although I don't, again, art itself is also beautiful. And I think art is beautiful in terms of expressing the complexity of human nature and the human condition. But I remember definitely when I was younger, and I was really disillusioned with, you know, my dating life and how people treated each other. And I'm like, humankind is horrible. I was very Hobbesian. and I would look out at a sunset. It's like, well, at least nature is always pretty.
Right. Right. One of my favorite places to visit is Colorado. So, you know, go up in the mountains and kind of away from people. But I'm also an artist and an appreciator. I'm a pop culture nerd. So it's like, I think that both things can be equally as moving as each other.
I really like in Colorado was a Bryce Canyon. That was my favorite.
Oh, I don't think I've ever been there.
It's great. I like it more than the Grand Canyon, but yeah, that's just me.
Cool.
So yeah, we could go on and on about nature, but yeah, we talked a little bit about, you know, Emily and again her status as damsel in distress. One note I have here is the relationship Emily has with her aunt, and I get so triggered when her aunt gaslights her and slut shames her in the beginning.
Yes, she does. That really surprised me. Like, go ahead.
Emily is just like, okay, there's a guy we met. We met him when my father was alive, so there wasn't anything, you know, sneaky or inappropriate about it. He's one of our acquaintances, and her aunt is trying to, you know, basically, I think her aunt, I don't know whether she truly believes it or not. I think she's just trying to paint Emily as this bad egg or backseat just so she can justify treating her poorly because she's already pissed off that she is now left with the duty of taking care of her.
Which that reminded me of Jane Eyre.
This is a trope in Gothic literature, the really shitty aunt.
The really shitty aunt with the sad orphan girl. Yes. That really surprised me when all of a sudden she was very slut-shamey. Because it made me go, did I miss something? Like, did she catch her, like, in the woods, like, you know, getting down or something? Like, I don't know. And then I was like, no, this lady just is a very...
Yeah. And as we progressed with their relationship, you know, before and after she marries Montini, and this also occurs in other books by Anne Radcliffe, and the sort of what commentary is Anne Radcliffe trying to say about the relationship between older women and younger women? Because I feel like my kind of probably very modern, very skewed perception is that is she trying to say something like, you know, these older women have kind of sold out to the patriarchy and are you know, clinging to these clinging to the power they have over, you know, younger women because they don't have any power over the men in their lives. And so, like, they try to take whatever power that the patriarchy gives them over their younger counterparts of their gender. But yeah, because, yeah, what is it trying to say about always pitting the older generation, specifically the females versus young versus old?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, I think that I absolutely hate that, like, reiteration of normalcy on that, because I've experienced it in my, you know, in my working life too, having younger people come on, and, you know, older people being resentful because of that. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? Like, you're just trying to continue on a stereotype. But I think for some people, some women, I think you're exactly right. I think it shows like a, you know, well, I've just kind of come to the realization that my life is overruled by the masculine male powers that be. So I might as well like take it out on this younger girl. Again, I don't know, like not my favorite, and also gives aunts a bad name as an aunt myself. I think I'm all right.
Yes, yes, indeed. And what was I going to say? Oh yeah, just, oh my God, what was I going to say? Oh no, never mind. It'll come back to me. But yeah, so during this whole time, her mother dies, her father dies, and she actually originally like comes to some sort of agreement that she wants to stay in her country castle at La Voisin or Valais or wherever it is. And then like basically her aunt says, no, you're coming with us to this place.
Yeah, not a lot of choice in her life. She's kind of being dragged around, I guess.
Yeah, she's being dragged around, but luckily Valancourt is persistent, and of course it shows how fickle her aunt is and how obsessed her aunt is with, you know, status and society and all those things, you know, comparing, you know, because this aunt was her father's sister. And it's interesting to see this commentary because in modern culture, it's very well established that the correct thing is that it's on the inside that should count. And if you care only about status and society and those sort of things, that's pretty well established in mainstream pop culture, that if you only care about those things, then you're extremely superficial. And we consider that an extremely negative quality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to see it, you know, shown in the 18th century, where people still do very much care about those things, and that's not necessarily considered a vice. But we have this early commentary of people like Anne Radcliffe trying to say that maybe this isn't the best way to, you know, assess the value of something or someone.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I think that's something that a lot of novels at this time do focus a lot on is societal status. And for me, you know, when I'm reading books like this, that's the part that I always kind of care the least about. I'm sure like it was something at the time that it was written that was very, I'm trying to say, it was something very controversial and, you know, people
prominent.
It's something that people thought a lot about. So any sort of, you know, subverting that was very, like, I think that does have some of its appeal. Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. And Jane Austen does the same thing too, which I think is, yeah, because Jane Austen wasn't too long after Anne Radcliffe.
That's, I was thinking particularly about Jane Austen, and I know you have read a lot of Jane Austen. I am a weirdo and I have not read a lot of Jane Austen. So honestly, most of my Jane Austen knowledge comes from your sister's lovely podcast. So
thank you. Yeah.
That's a plug there for you too.
Yeah. All right. Yes. Thank you. It's interesting with her aunt and, you know, Valancourt. At first she's like, oh, I don't like Valancourt. Like, he's this, he's that, he's nothing. And then the moment she finds out that he is actually the nephew of someone important that she holds in high status, she's like, okay with it.
You know, I guess from that perspective, that's kind of like, that never has left our society. Because I feel like that's, you know, if somebody's like the relative of some celebrity or, you know, sports figure, it's kind of like, oh, well, we better like bow down, or like, now I'm interested. So I guess, you know, there are some things in society that never change.
No, they never go away. And for me personally, because I've studied abroad so much in the Middle East, and, you know, that we cultures that we might consider more traditional, this is definitely still very much a factor in terms of arranged marriages and stuff. In fact, I've read one article like several years ago that was specifically an article discussing how much Pakistani women enjoy Jane Austen novels, because all of those things of like marriage and status and all of these and money and all of those things, we think of that being a little archaic in Western society, but for them, like, they basically are living that, you know, and having to deal with those issues and trying to reconcile their personal feelings with all of these societal, either wider societal expectations or the expectations of their immediate and extended family.
That's really interesting. I mean, that is very interesting to think about how those novels might resonate just in different parts of the world. I guess I'm looking at it through, as a very American, you know, Midwestern person, I'm looking at it through those eyes. Rather than it's really good. It reminds me of a book I read a couple of years ago called, Erotic Stories for Punjabi Widows or something. It was about a,
oh, I remember you telling me about this.
Yeah. They read romance novels and then they ended up writing romance stories and it was kind of liberating for them. I would say it's pretty light, but, it was a good perspective. I had a book club pre this book club, that we read a lot of books from different cultures, and it's always nice to have like a different perspective in window when I don't really get that in my day-to-day life. So I find that very interesting about the Jane Austen.
Yeah. So we find out that Valancourt is the nephew of actually someone important, and so the aunt is on board with it, but then the aunt marries the Italian nobleman Montini, and Montini has decided just to completely kibosh this would-be engagement between Emily and Valancourt and ships them all off to Italy.
Why not? I have a question for you regarding the Italian before we get too far. Is Radcliffe's book, The Italian, related to this book at all?
No.
Okay.
No, they're curious. None of them are like sequels. They're all standalones.
Okay. I didn't know if she just like took a character and was like, I'm going to expand on that. I don't really know a lot about the Italian. So interesting.
I've read like a third or half of the Italian. I haven't finished it. Not because I think it's bad. It's just, I was listening to audiobook and the audiobook was really, really bad. The guy who was doing it was again, doing this girly damsel in distress voice. And again, like pissing me off with the very oversimplification of the heroines. And so I stopped.
A bad audio reader can really ruin. So I don't blame.
Yeah. Italian is a standalone, and so they first go to Venice, and you know it's all the parties that are happening, and then there's basically what I really honed on was the would be courtship of Count Murano to Emily.
Okay.
And basically what happens is Montini wants Emily to marry Count Murano. And Emily is just like, no, I'm not going to do that. And she tells Count Murano this, but Count Murano like doesn't accept it. He just thinks, oh, I just have to try harder. And again, the very typical no doesn't mean no. No means try harder that men try to tell themselves.
Gross. Yeah, I hate that. So
I hated that. And then I have a very special note here. So basically there's a point where Emily is considering like, if I tell Count Murano about Valancourt, will that make him leave me alone when he knows that there is actually an object of my affection? And then she gets mad at herself and she's like, no, screw that. I shouldn't have to tell him. My simple answer and my autonomy, I'm paraphrasing, but my autonomy should be enough. I shouldn't have to, give this information about Valancourt for him to leave me alone. So I felt that was very, very modern, and I liked that about Emily.
I was going to say that is very progressive of her. Good for her. That's wonderful. Montini, is that how you're saying it?
Montini is her like new uncle.
Okay, Montini. Yeah, kind of the classic gothic villain, kind of a
mustache twirling and everything.
Yeah. Yes, that's a perfect image, the mustache twirling. That's awesome.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I can understand why people see Montini as this sort of cartoonish villain, but at the same time, there are legitimately people out there who will go so much out of their way to make your life miserable. And so I'm thinking, is this really a cartoon or not?
You make an excellent point for having no point of reference, but yeah, there are some people that just don't get the hint. You can even state it bluntly and they seem like you've said, it's more of a challenge than it is no, please leave me alone.
Yeah. And then there's especially, Montini's trick with Emily with the letter. Do you remember that?
I do not. Refresh my
mind. So basically, it's the sense where Emily is so consumed with the realization that like her family's like lawyer has, you know, rented her old castle out to someone else, and she's thinking about this. And so she's talking to Montini, thinking she's talking about this sort of real estate issue, where in reality, Montini has a letter and he's talking about, and he's deliberately obtuse about it, about Count Murano's proposal. And so he traps her into thinking, oh, I accept this, you know, thinking that, you know, Montini is basically trying to trick her into accepting Count Murano's proposal. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to sit here and say, I pretended that you made a mistake, and realizing just how stubborn he is. And I think those specific words were that it was not by accident, but it was literally by design.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which you made me think of some letters, and maybe we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the same thing, and my memory is just a little scrambled, but that she burns, that her father tells her to burn.
Yes, there are those letters that she burns because, yeah, her father requested her to do so, but she keeps the locket of the woman.
Okay.
Yeah, because her father did not specifically tell her to get rid of the locket, so she's like, okay, technically I can keep it.
that's pretty funny. The by design, the letters, that's just kind of easy business.
Again, eventually it comes out that, you know, they keep trying. It gets to a point where Montini is at the point where he's like, the wedding will happen tomorrow and you will attend and everything. And, you know, dueling all this bullying and intimidating behavior. And it made me think of, I have a note here of legal versus real pressure for Emily to marry. And that's going into that whole paradox of, yes, legally, Montini cannot force Emily to marry who he wants. But at the same time, there are no social mechanisms in place to protect her if he tries to cut off all her resources because she's not giving in to what he wants, even though he doesn't have a legal basis for it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think we're talking more about that, you know, that's emblematic. I don't know if that's the right word, of the period in which this is taking place.
And I think it's showing a very strong commentary of, again, that social criticism, because even it made me think of, before I went for my master's thesis, I ended up going in a sociolinguistic route, but for a long time I thought my master's thesis was going to be about honor crimes in the Middle East, which is basically when a male member of a family kills his either daughter or sister because she's perceived to have brought shame onto the family.
Right, yes.
And so a lot of times in leading up to those honor crimes, what happens is they know, especially if they're in a diaspora community in the West, they know they're not legally in a position to force it. So they exert all this emotional blackmail and all these other, try to cut off all other sort of resources to her and for the woman to cave in. And again, and there's no mechanism to protect women. Like, what if all my resources are cut off from me to the point that the people who are supposed to take care of me will throw me on the street, even though they have no legal basis for their demand.
Man, I mean, I guess, and hopefully I'm understanding this right, if anything, that's almost like they have a protection to do that in, you know, in America, freedom of religion. And I think that if I'm thinking about female genital mutilation. I know a lot of reasoning some people have not gotten involved is because there's the excuse of like, or the reasoning that's how that culture works. So, you know, that's just what happens. So I think that's interesting, and kind of looking at this in a different perspective now with this information, it's like, well, you know, the legal recourse almost is just to kind of say, oh, well, if that's, you know, part of your religion. I know people kind of get a little outlandish with some of that stuff. They'll take it really far. Before gay marriage was legalized, people are like, well, maybe what if you have it? I don't want to. Well, let me back up. But, you know, certain churches were like, I'm not going to perform a ceremony for two men. The thing is, it's like, nobody's asking you to. What we're saying is something completely different. So, religion and legalities, which, you know, I'm looking at in Radcliffe, and it said there were apparently were some accusations of anti-Catholicism in her works.
She's super anti-Catholic.
That's fine. that's I mean, you know, interesting. But
Again, I'm biased and not because I'm not too upset by that, because even though I'm not Christian anymore, I was raised Lutheran, so it was always boo with the corrupt Catholics.
And I was raised Catholic, so I have the an insider knowledge of the church. So and some of the history and some of the ways things work, though. But that's really interesting. And I know, with that being said, I know anybody who's kind of writing about things like that are in the negative did not go over very well in certain sects.
Yeah. And again, probably another reason, because she was so anti-Catholic, probably another reason why she had a lot of her books take place in Italy, because that was the easiest place to have access to Catholic characters and monks.
Yes, complete sense.
So yeah, so because Montini is harboring a fugitive in his house, Orsini, they end up having to leave Venice very, very quickly and go to his old dilapidated castle known as Udolpho.
Finally, we get to Udolpho.
I was really surprised that for the title being Udolpho, it was only like 200 pages of the book.
I wonder if she struggled with the title, because I mean, we've got like a 600, 700 page book here and there's a lot going on, but I believe this was many books. And I think I've read the title as like, The Mysteries of Udolpho, a romance interspersed with pieces of poetry. So I wonder what made her finally say, like, I'm going to land on The Mysteries of Udolpho. But that is where some of the more supernatural things take place. I mean, we already had like the ghost or, you know, whomever with the music toward the beginning of the novel. But
yeah, and I think maybe it's also Mr. Udolpho, because even though we leave the physical place of Udolpho behind, the mystery of what happens with the count that that she's staying with, and you know, the late Marchioness of his property, like that ends up going back to Udolpho. So I think that's partially why, because even though we leave Udolpho physically, the spirit of the secrets of Udolpho continue.
That would make sense. That would make sense.
Yeah, but yeah, we get to Udolpho, and again, very typical, dilapidated castle, creepy stuff. Definitely a big part of Anne Radcliffe's work is the babbling, you know, very superstitious housemaids and domestic servants.
Yes. Oh, and that's, I mean, and we've seen that in other Gothic novels too.
Castle of Otranto also.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, obviously, I guess they're kind of in the same realm, so.
Yeah, because it's supposed to be like comic relief where Annette is like trying to tell something to Emily about what happened, and Emily's just like, get to the point, Annette, and she's like, no, I have to tell it in my own way. And there's another scene in like Romance of the Forest where the servant says the exact thing. It's like, just shut up and tell me what I need to know. And he's like, no, I got to go through this whole long-winded tale.
I mean, was the author making fun of herself here? Because like
in a way, I wonder, given to some of the things I noticed by reading Northanger Abbey, but we'll get to that next episode.
Okay. Yeah, very curious.
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, there's this whole deal about the black veil, and Emily faints when she sees what's behind the black veil, but the narrator does not tell us what's behind the black veil.
I wonder, as far as a device, which disappointing, but also leaves it to the imagination, which I know in watching like new movies and things like shows, whatever, the kind of the effectiveness of letting your mind kind of wander and not actually seeing the thing is sometimes more haunting. Like she is not Poe, you know. Poe is gory, in my opinion, and comparatively. So there is definitely more left to the imagination, which I would argue is more effective in kind of the kind of having that terror, underlining terror throughout the novel. So, and I love a black veil. It reminds me of just a lot of cool imagery throughout Gothic.
Yeah, I don't know what I felt about the black veil not being revealed for a long time. And again, it kind of does build the suspense a little bit, but at the same time, I felt like if she can get away with not revealing it for a really long time, then that must mean that it's not that relevant to the plot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in that way, it kind of deflates the suspense, if you will, because what it end up being is just like this old waxen statue. It's like not like it's not like a corpse or anything, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I would have liked it better if it ended up being a like something really creepy that wasn't relevant to Adolfo, but was relevant to maybe like the latter third of the story with the Count and the sister Agnes and like that whole subplot.
Yeah, I could see, or just, you know, something to her past. I don't know, but
yeah. So that was my opinion on the Black Veil. But yeah, then she realizes that. So she Emily notices that things are really bad between Montini and her aunt, his wife, and it's gotten to a point where he is trying to pressure her into signing off the lands that she has to like help, you know, deal with all the debts he has. And she's saying no. And again, the same thing of legally, he cannot force her, but she is his wife and he can do all sorts of things to her practically to give her consent. And it gets to a point where the aunt dies.
So, yeah, I mean, so he makes her life a living hell and then.
Yeah. And then she dies and then everything Emily inherits everything.
Yes. That's it. Again, Jane Eyre, right? She inherited a bunch of things when somebody died.
So she inherits the lands, and so then Montini turns his attention to Emily being like, you better you know, sign this off to me, and she resists for a really, really long time, which again shows her fortitude and her strength despite having very little power in this given situation. I'm not sure if I could have, you know, held out for that long, because she only finally gives in when he's like, you will never see France again. You will never see anything you love again. If you sign all this away to me, I will let you go. And then she finally caves in. But shocker, he's a double crosser and locks her up anyway.
No surprise there. Now, at one point we were talking about like Gothic stories, and I think there was a book that you mentioned, and the title escapes me. I'm sure you'll be able to think of it. But I think that you said in Gothic literature, that's kind of one of the things that like is of interest to you. The woman in the castle. Oh gosh, I can't find the book title. I'm feverishly scanning through my books.
We have always lived in the castle. That's Shirley Jackson. That's pretty modern. I don't think that's it.
The Silent Companions is the one.
Oh, yeah. The Silent Companions.
Yeah. So, it's just interesting that, I mean, of course he's kind of we kind of know he's not a great guy. But the locking people in a castle, and that's where she starts to hear things and maybe losing it, that's where that kind of mystery starts. Am I right?
Yeah. In Silent Companions or?
Oh, in this book. Sorry. I hopped. Oh, yeah. I was just thinking of that kind of like storyline, and I knew that that was something that you found interesting. But in this specific book, she is locked in the castle and then she starts hearing things.
Yeah. And then there's the creepiness of Count Murano that breaks into her room.
Yeah, that's gross and creepy.
That's horrible. Creepy, and it's, you know, and again shows her fortitude, because she could, you know, basically Count Murano is totally operating by himself because Montini has not honored, you know, their promise, because he got swept away in holding Orsini as a fugitive in his house, and so he's totally broken off that engagement and is not helping Count Murano anymore. But Murano himself is trying to get Emily for himself, and he's like, you know, he's not a good man, like, you know, come with me, I'll save you. And again, this idea of trying to be the knight in shining armor, but are you really a knight in shining armor, like just going from out of the kettle and into the fire?
Right. Yeah, not really.
Yeah, because that's a lot. I feel like that happens a lot with women, but also probably men too, is like people get into, you know, are in a bad situation, whether they're family of origin or relationship. And so they immediately try to escape it. But the thing they escape to is just as bad, it's not, if not worse.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it, to take it to like a very, I guess, sad place, where I was watching, I don't remember what movie I was watching the other day, but it was like a woman went from an abuse. Oh, it was It too. A woman went from, she had the girl character, I don't remember, she's played Jessica Chastain, goes from like an abusive, possibly, you know, sexually abusive as well, father, to an abusive husband. And so it's, you know, again, that it's escaping one bad for something else. So that's an interesting.
And then again, it shows Emily's good character, because she could just tell to herself, okay, I'll use Murano to get out of Adolfo, and then because Murano likes me, I'll probably have a more easy time like escaping from him. But she doesn't. It's like, no, I'm just gonna stay in the one cesspool that I'm in.
Right, the one cesspool. I like your wording.
Yeah, because there are no good choices.
No, there are not.
Like the election.
That, you know, oh man.
I'm totally going to be a third party voter.
Are you really?
Yeah, just I don't like this huge dichotomy anymore, and I'm very disillusioned with it, because quite frankly, Joe Biden is not that progressive. He just is the sanity compared to Trump.
Yeah.
But we won't bother people with our politics. The point of some of this podcast is to get away from that.
Yeah, there we go.
So she finally escapes Adolfo with the help of Monsieur Dupont. And Dupont was being held in Adolfo. I forget why, but he's actually really liked Emily for a long, long time. And he was the one who stole her bracelet at the very, very beginning of the book.
Oh my gosh. So she's really like committed to throwing it back. So because
I'm just going to be, it's going to be important. Like, who stole this bracelet? Who stole this bracelet? Who stole this bracelet?
that's, I mean, good for her. And then good for like, I guess that's an exciting thing to read, because you're like, oh yeah, that I remember that. So, interesting.
So yeah, they escape Adolfo, Annette, Ludovico, Emily, and Dupin, and they are rescued by this count who was living somewhere else, but a certain Marquis has died and has left I know I have a character list here. Ooh, where are they? Annette. Count de Villefort.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Count de Villefort. Yeah. So he inherits this new castle, and he comes across, you know, the escapees. And so they end up, you know, kind of staying near each other for a while. They end up being friends and all that. And that triggers like the last third of the book about the mystery of the late Marchioness.
Yes. And that gets involved with the some of the noises going on in the castle, if I remember right.
Yeah, some of the noises, and then we get, you know, the housekeeper of that, what is it, Chateau Le Blanc? Is that what it's called?
I think so. Gosh, there was ton of names in here. I'm trying to find it. Yes, that's right.
Again, I speak French. I should have memorized all of these, but I think it's Chateau Le Blanc. So we get into the housekeeper, who is Dorothy, and who was very devoted to the late Marchioness, the late mistress. And this made me think of what Julia said back in Rebecca, because Julia mentioned to us that the character of Mrs. Danvers, the evil one in Rebecca, is actually a subversion of this original housekeeper, Dorothy, in Mysteries of Adolfo.
I totally forgot she said that, but that's, yeah, now I remember that.
Yeah, so I actually have a quote that I have from one of Julia's articles from her website, Gothic Librarian. You guys should go check it out.
Yes.
Yeah, so here it says, the trope of the creepy housekeeper goes as far back as the earliest Gothic novels. One of the most popular of these novels, The Mystery of Udolpho by Anne Radcliffe, features an old housekeeper named Dorothy. In this early example, the housekeeper is not a malicious character, and her creepiness stems primarily from her ominous allusions to the past and hints at supernatural occurrences. She is morbidly devoted to her dead mistress and spends much of the novel bemoaning the deteriorating state of the castle, longing for the days where her mistress was alive, and encouraging the young protagonist Emily to believe in and fear the supernatural. Let's see what else. Oh, come on. Yeah, that's it. So again, as Julia described, you know, it's still kind of creepy, but it's, again, not intended to be an ominous or antagonistic creepiness or devotion, whereas with Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca, that's just completely flipped, where it's a devotion that is evil and directly antagonistic to our current protagonist in Rebecca.
Yeah, that there was, I mean, quirky is one thing, but like malicious and kind of plotting your demise is a total different thing. So.
And telling you to go jump out the window.
Yeah. That's not really what you want in a serve at all.
Yeah, but then it ends. But then it comes out that, you know, at first we get, you know, Emily has been visiting this nearby convent near Chateau Leblanc because that's kind of where she stayed, like right after her father died. So she has some kind of fond memories there and knows the nuns a little bit. And there's this whole mystery behind Sister Agnes and like what's the whole deal, who was Sister Agnes before she entered the convent. And so the abbess or someone tells her that the Sister Agnes came along because she was a noblewoman who wanted to marry this one noblewoman or one nobleman but couldn't and got married to someone else, and he didn't like her and got fed up with her, so basically kind of shoved her in a convent. And it's all set up to suggest that maybe the previous owner of Chateau Leblanc, the Marquis, basically shoved the late Marchioness into the convent. And so maybe the late Marchioness isn't actually dead. She's actually Sister Agnes.
Oh my gosh. Like,
so yeah, so that's what it's supposed to be. And that's how she builds it up. But in reality, dun, 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 Sister Agnes is not the late Marchioness. She is in fact Signora Luda, oh my god, what's the name? Signoras.
Laurentini?
Yeah, Signora Laurentini, who is the one that got swindled out of Adolfo by Montini.
I'm sorry. But the like, what a whirlwind of names and like property exchange here. Like, goodness gracious.
Yeah, and not only did she, not only is she not the late Marchioness, but she helped the Marquis to conspire to kill the late Marchioness. So she poisoned the Marchioness in hopes of becoming, marrying him and becoming Marchioness himself. But that did not happen because the Marquis was so guilt-ridden that he didn't marry her and just went off into seclusion and died.
How lovely. Also, this is a great example of that anti-Catholicism in the Anne Radcliffe tales. Like the sister, I guess it's kind of suggesting that like, why else would you go and be a nun unless you had like some secret that you're trying to run from or something?
Yeah, well, not necessarily secret, but I remember I took in my freshman year of college a history class that was all about the history of Venice.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so it's just the sad reality that especially in Italy and Catholic states and countries, like convents were the way that you got rid of daughters and sisters you didn't want to deal with. And, you know, that was just the reality of it. And, you know, so the fact that, you know, the fact that Anne Radcliffe's nuns have these totally lucrative past, in a way, you know, it's over the top for the novel, but in a way it kind of makes sense because so many of those noble women were just shut away there for their own, for either at best an inconvenience and at worst some sort of legal threat to whatever male relatives that were responsible for them.
First of all, that's really interesting history, and it also makes complete sense. For some reason, I'm thinking of a movie about Irish. I always called it the nunnery, but that's probably
Ireland's Catholic too. So
yeah, that, I was thinking of Monty Python, which my brain just went like
another shrubbery.
Yes, and get thee to a nunnery.
And then on top of all of that with Signora Laurentini, is that her name?
Laurentini.
Sister Agnes. Then there's the question of, is this woman actually Emily's mother?
Mm.
And it turns out that it's not her mother, but actually it's her aunt. And that's why her father had a picture, the locket looked exactly like what Sister Agnes used to look like when very young, that they were brother and sister. So it's not her mother, it's her aunt.
Well, thank God. It'd probably be devastating for old Emily.
Yep.
What a tangled web, these all these characters. I mean, I guess it's kind of to be expected over 600.
Actually, I was really surprised because, I don't know, I was thinking that, you know, like with Castle of Otranto, like these sort of like secret these secret children or bastards and all these, you know, convoluted relationships. You know, it's done in a dramatic sense where you think you can guess it, but I actually did not guess this one. And so I felt like the twist she did was actually kind of much more modern than I was anticipating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I don't know if, I think she is surprisingly, there are some surprising modern elements to her writing that it just kind of makes me sad that not enough people really remember her unless you're in a certain circle. Also, she has my birthday too, so just.
Oh, really? When's your birthday?
July 9th. And she was born. Okay. Now, I was not born in 1764, but. Yeah, that's just.
Yep. And then, of course, yeah, all that mystery gets solved and Valancourt and Emily marry and everything is all hunky-dory.
Yeah. And then everything's tied up in a nice little bow.
And Emily is loaded with so much money and estates.
Living the dream. That's kind of like the ultimate. That seems like to be a very Jane Austen thing too, that there's like the conclusion is that the and correct me if I'm wrong, obviously, but the conclusion seems to be that we are, you know, live in a wealthy, happy place and finally end up with the man we love, and then we move on, and I don't know, all the ghosts aren't real, and
yeah, very Jane Eyre. Yeah, oh, I forgot what I was gonna say. Yeah, well, I think what you're saying, like the sense, I think the sense of money is the sort of poetic justice again that Emily had so little power, you know, in her situations, and so by being virtuous and strong throughout all of those in her own subtle way, she is rewarded by having, you know, through all these circumstances, ending up with a lot of cash and a lot of land.
Yeah, that's, yeah, that makes sense. That it's just, it's interesting to me. And I don't know if that's really a theme of Gothic literature, but it is definitely of, I feel like stories from this time. First of all, I think you did a really good job of wrapping all of that up, because there was a lot there. One thing that this was kind of the thing that, and I feel like if people have listened to this, they know that I'm like, where are the ghosts or where are the whatever. There was there was that element there. And then I think this book has made me realize what kind of Gothic literature I like. And it is more in the vein of, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein. And there's definitely, so there, that is an element of Gothic literature. It's funny because I've realized it's like, okay, it's not quite Poe. Poe's a little gory for me, but it's not quite, not quite so, the classism and things like that is something that if a Gothic novel does not have those elements, I'm okay with. But that was something that I realized after, you know, reading this book.
You're definitely a lover of the 19th century monsters.
Yes, I am. That is where my heart resides.
Yeah. I enjoy both of them. And again, just showing the evolution of the Gothic. And it's interesting in a way that that Anne Radcliffe doesn't go in the supernatural direction, because it's true in all of her books. There's never a real ghost. It's always explained in some logical, rational way. But the ironic thing about it is, all of these books about the splendidity of nature, that is all in Romanticism and a pushback from the Enlightenment, which is all about logic and rationale. So I think it's trying to show that you can, I think it's trying to make the point that you can be, you can have reservations about certain technological or civilizations advancements, but also still be logical. And therefore the criticisms of the Enlightenment aren't just, you know, backward religious whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense as far as that's a really good observation. I was going to try to relate it to modern life, but I lost my through line, so never mind.
Yeah, but yeah, that's, yeah, because I literally just realized that 30 seconds ago, because it's like all this is about, you know, fight, you know, Romanticism against the Enlightenment, but at the same time there's never any true supernatural elements to Anne Radcliffe. Was there in Castle? Yes, there were real elements in Otranto when the picture moved. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the most, like, this Otranto, and I mean, I just see elements of Jane Eyre here in this book is kind of, that's the thing that I kept thinking.
Yeah, Jane Eyre is a very updated, again, 19th century version of, again, that heroine.
Yeah. I mean, good heroine for this book. It's, you know, and the thing is, like, as I'm reading this, I'm like, this is not gothic by any means. This is gothic. This is very much, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, this is very gothic. It's just, it's also what I was thinking of, you know, kind of was reflecting on it this morning in anticipation of this. I used to work at a music store, and we had a catch-all section. So I sold compact discs, if I'm giving away my age here. It was super fun, but we had a section called alternative rock, and it always made me laugh because you would find anything from like Nine Inch Nails to Blink-182 to Portishead, and it's like, okay, that's technically alternative, but those are very different kind of, there are elements of that. So it just kind of helped me kind of put in context like gothic literature. So we have our varieties, you know, we have our kind of our ghosts that aren't ghosts is what I say. We have our monsters, we have different elements, but they're all kind of lumped into this. So, I mean, we're going to talk about our goth meter in a little while. Sure. That just kind of helped me kind of understand gothic as a bigger kind of grouping of literature that I'm not sure I fully realized until then. And thank you, Anne Radcliffe, for helping me have that realization.
Yeah, I think the way to look at it is, you know, gothic literature at its core is reactionary, and it's reacting to whatever of what's going on at the time. And so because there's not very supernatural elements like in Anne Radcliffe, I think it's more of it's a political reaction, again, French Revolution and discussing the corruption of the aristocracy. So it's much more of a political reaction. And not that the Industrial Revolution was well underway, but of course, you know, industrialization really sped along in the 19th century. And so I think naturally with things like Frankenstein and Dracula, we're seeing a reaction not so much to politics, but to technology.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. So can I ask you, I mean, we're in like our second season of gothic literature, and I guess I've had that, like, this realization. I'm going to make an assumption. Yeah. I'm not going to make an assumption. What is your preference? I know you said you kind of like both, you know, but do you have a preference? Like, if you were presented with, I'm not going to say Frankenstein, because I know there's not a lot of love there. But let's say you're presented with Mysteries of Udolpho and Dracula. Is there one kind of motif that you prefer over the other? Or is it just you're kind of like, they're both kind of in that realm and I would enjoy them equally?
They're both in the realm, again, just objectively as gothic. In terms of what I prefer, I think it really much depends on the type of monster, because I am a sucker for vampires. So that specific one, I'm going to choose Dracula.
Okay, yes. That was unfair of me.
But if it's, you know, and when it comes to ghosts, I'm okay with the ghosts being real or not. I'm okay with the ghost not being real if the suspense is done in a really nice way that I still went along for a really good ride despite it not being real. But at the same time, there have been books that I've gotten to where I was disappointed by the letdown that the supernatural element wasn't real.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. It also reminded me of the BookTube video that you did. And I think your screen grab is you holding a copy of The 13th Tale. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it made me think, like, that to me was one of my favorite ghosts that aren't ghosts. Like, that, the way that that wrapped up, which I'm not going to spoil anything, but that was my favorite way that.
Yeah, I know. And again, because, you know, it's just the way the specific writer does it. And I was worried about 13th Tale because I already knew from Jane Eyre that you get really hung up on when there are no real ghosts. But I'm like, yeah, this is so well done. I hope she'll like it. And you did. So yeah, it just depends on who's doing it and how they're doing it. Just in general terms, I tend to be fairly equal.
Yeah.
Between, yeah.
Yeah, I don't mind a good thriller. And I think that you know, I don't have to have a monster in every book. I really don't. I read plenty of non-monstery books. But anyway, thank you for answering that question. I'm sad I picked Dracula. I wish I would have picked something else.
But yeah, the one book I've read recently where the monster wasn't real was The Essex Serpent.
Oh, I don't know this one.
Yeah, it's really good. It's lighter on gothic, but it is very, it's a really good historical fiction of Victorian time. But yeah, that was the one that I was kind of disappointed. I'm like, oh, I wanted the sea dragon to be real.
Oh, man, that is a bummer. A dragon not being real?
I know. Or not even a fossil being real either.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, shall we move on to the Gothometer?
Let's do it.
Alrighty then. Again, category number one is atmosphere and setting.
I guess I'll go. I don't know why. I think this was, like I said, I'm going to give it a 10 right out the gate. I think that this is a good, like, again, if you were going to say, like, I want to write a gothic novel and help me find some examples, I would say, here you go. Here's this book. Not only have I don't think I've complained, I've just noted that she uses a lot of words. So the atmosphere is very present. Now, is it always very like foreboding? I don't know, but I think it's very descriptive. When we get to the castle settings, like absolutely, the atmosphere is quintessential gothic. What about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm out of the gate going to give it a 10 as well, again, for all those things, because, you know, I was more aware of just how much the splendidity of nature was an element of early Gothic literature and knew that was coming. And in some ways, I think the darker element of the atmospheric is contrasting the sublimity of nature and how wonderful nature is compared to, like, man-made construction, so all the castles are dark and creepy and yucky.
That's a very good observation. I mean, like, yeah, they're definitely contrasting those two things. I'm jealous I didn't say that, Amy. That's so good.
Alrighty then. Category number two, the past. What do you think?
There are elements of the past here. I'm thinking of kind of, you know, the sadness of the father over the mother. I mean, is it recent past? Sure. You know, kind of what you were talking about with Sister Agnes, kind of the connection to the past being a player in the future, for lack of a better term. I don't really know. I'm never good at rating this one on our Gothometer, so I'm going to give it an 8 without completely understanding why I did. How about you?
2 for 2. I give it 8 as well.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm giving it an 8, again, because there are a lot of references to the past, like Adolfo, like who was the original owner before Montini got a hold of the castle, and again, the past with Chateau Leblanc and the late Marchioness, the recent past of Emily constantly thinking about Valancourt, where is he, can he come rescue me, blah, 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 and so yeah, all of those things, I give it 8.
Okay, good. Well, I'm not that far off. That makes me feel good.
Okay, category number three, the supernatural.
Well, I've made my feelings on the supernatural very clear. Then she did the thing with the ghost that's not a ghost. That always breaks my heart. I'm giving it a 3.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay.
I'm giving it a 7 because, again, like you said, like I will count the thriller element of the potentiality of ghosts just as much as there actually being a ghost literally.
Yes.
And so just that potentiality of ghost, that was in Adolfo, and then that was also in Castle La Planche with late Marchioness and her rooms and, you know, all of those things. And even in Emily's original home, like when the bracelet is stolen, just thinking like, is something going on there? So yeah, for all that suspense, I give it 7.
Perfect.
Then category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains.
I'm going to give this an 8, and solely because of Emily. you know, I'm going to give, okay, here, I'll rephrase that. I'll give it a higher score than maybe I would have in the past, because Emily is a strong gothic heroine, so props to that. And you know, there are actual characters in this story, which sounds like a very stupid thing to say out of context, but I feel like, you know, I feel like when, you know, Emily is talking about missing her mother or having conversations with her father or encountering Montini, they're people. They're, you can kind of, like, they're fleshed out. It's just a phrase I use a lot, I know. Moreover, some of the other books that we've read, specifically I'm contrasting this in my mind with The Castle of Otranto. So I'm going to give it an 8. What are your thoughts?
I am going to give it a 10.
Whoa, all right.
I'm giving it a 10 because, again, I feel like at the surface you might dismiss, like, the hero, heroine, and villain as, like, very cardboard, two-dimensional. But quite honestly, again, you know, as you said, Emily's very well fleshed out, showing strength, but also, you know, weaknesses. She cries, and that's okay. And I, you know, I like seeing that sort of strong, quiet femininity. I think, you know, in pop culture, I think that's a recent backlash to the fact that the super tomboy feminist like Arya Stark, it doesn't really represent a good majority of women.
Right.
So, you know, I like that part. And then again, Valancourt as a hero, I really like him because he's a good guy, but at the same time, he's flawed because there's the whole subplot that we didn't even talk about of him like getting into debt and that sort of thing. And, you know, Emily wondering, is he a good candidate or not? So showing a good guy that had flaws.
That's a good observation. I think it's also good.
Well, I certainly think he was a hell of a lot more fleshed out than Theodore in Romance of the Forest and Theodore in Castle of Otranto.
I think something that you did a really good job of, you know, kind of covering, hitting the points. There is just so much going on in this book that, you know, I don't know if I have time to sit here for like 6 hours, but I'm sure we could. If we really wanted to come through this book, we could.
Like, this is something that, like, you would need to do, like, chapter by chapter, like we're going to do with Harry Potter.
Yes, exactly.
And it would take, like, 2 years.
Yeah, oh my God. I'm glad we're doing that with Harry Potter. That's what I'll say. I'm glad we're doing that.
Okay. So, and then finally, category number 5, mystery. What did you think?
I'm going to give it a 10 for mystery. There were little mysterious elements throughout the book. What a stupid thing to say. Sorry, I'm laughing myself. But, you know, again, with Sister Agnes, with the veil, with what's in the paper, what was on the papers. I think she did a good job of creating a mystery here. So, I gave this story 2 tens. What are your thoughts on the mystery?
Before I finished the book, I gave it a 6 because I think maybe a lot of the things that maybe are mysterious, I kind of, you know, throw into the supernatural category, and the suspense, whatever. But then once we got to the very end and the super reveal of Sister Agnes, and I was like, whoa. So from that, it boosted up. I give it an 8.
Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. I'm trying to do our totals here to see what our...
Here, let me tally mine up.
Okay.
I gave it a 43 out of 50.
And I gave it a 39.
Nice.
Yeah. So we weren't too far off, but each other.
Not too far off. And I would definitely, you know, at some point, I don't know, in the next few episodes, like we should have in the Harry Potter episode, we should have done a tally of like the rankings of like all the novels at the end and see which one was technically most gothic.
Yeah, you know, we should. I have them written down, I think, for the most part. I have my little gothic, my gothic podcast, Sublimely Gothic Notebook. So I hope I wrote
them
down.
Yeah, we'll do that at some point. But definitely, I think this is on the higher list. I think the highest one so far was 13th Tale.
That's not surprising. That book was really good and really, that was a great example of the genre. I really like that book.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then, and now we can move on to our last exercise, which is the special rereading. And I've got the book right here, so I'm just going to pick something at random.
Cool.
One moment.
No problem.
My kitty's meowing.
I heard a kitty.
Now they're both crying.
Oh.
Yeah, my husband is feeding them.
Thank you. To your husband.
So let's see. spoiler random. It's hard to do it random because this book is so thick. So I already have a sense of like each. Okay, I'm going to do exactly in the middle. Okay, let's see. Eight other guests sat round the table who were all dressed in an uniform and had all an expression more or less of wild fierceness, of subtle design, or of licentious passions. As Emily timidly surveyed them, she remembered the scene of the preceding morning and again almost fancied herself surrounded by banditti. Then looking back to the tranquility of her early life, she felt scarcely less astonishment than grief at her present situation. The scene in which they sat assisted the illusion. It was an ancient hall, gloomy from the style of its architecture, from its great extent, and because almost the only light it received was from one large Gothic window and from a pair of folding doors, which being open admitted likewise a view of the west rampart with the wild mountains of the Apennine beyond.
I think that was a good random quote. I think it's a good example of a lot of things in the book.
I think this is definitely, it's page 312. I think she's in Udolpho and it's basically Montini and his gang. And basically they're a bunch of robbers at this point.
Okay. Yes.
So she's just kind of realizing that I'm with a whole bunch of crazy criminals.
Sorry. It's just not a bunch of crazy criminals. I having not read some of our upcoming books, I don't think that's something that we stumbled upon in previous books.
Alrighty then. I'm just trying to think of anything else to say. I'm like, what else can I say about this?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. Like I said, I think it helped me have some realizations about my preferences in Gothic literature. And I think that was just a cool kind of thing to have happen in reading, kind of understanding better your preferences and better to guide preferences. But I think Anne Radcliffe sounded like an interesting lady, and I'm sad that there is not a lot of information about her.
Yeah, so alrighty then, and that was the very condensed, abridged version of Mysteries of Udolpho. Yeah, so tune in next time, everyone, and we will go over the actual parody of Mysteries of Udolpho, Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen. And it'll be so interesting to now finally understand all those satires and parodies that have been lost throughout the ages because no one knows Udolpho anymore.
I think it's really interesting that we're going to be talking about this book because I don't typically read like a parody novel. I've always thought they were kind of like sometimes kind of pokey, but like a writer as accomplished as Jane Austen writing one, I'm very, very intrigued. And with your depth of knowledge on Jane Austen, the author, I can't wait to have that conversation.
Yeah, no, I'm going to be going over Northanger Abbey twice. I'm going to first do it with my sister, and then a week later, I'm going to do it with you. So I'm going to be like double whammy for Northanger Abbey on both podcasts.
Well, you will be like just a wealth of information. So that'll be very exciting. And I will be I have never read it before. Have you read it before?
Yes, I've read it before. It's in my top three.
Oh, okay. Jameson.
Like it's I really relate to Catherine. This is a good Catherine. This isn't like a Wuthering Heights Catherine. Catherine in Northanger Abbey is awesome.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm excited because a lot of Jane Austen I haven't read, so I think it'll be interesting to read this one.
Yep. All right then. Well, thank you so much again. Tune in next time for the satire of Gothic literature, Northanger Abbey. Bye.
Bye.